Welcome back to Introduction to International Relations. This lecture is about foregone benefits of cooperation. Before I offer any answers to the first big question I asked in Lecture 1, which I'll start to do in the very next lecture, I need to take some time to elaborate on why it's worth asking. That is, the main point of this lecture is to convince you that we really do have a puzzle. That a lot of money is being left lying on the ground, so to speak. That's a particularly good metaphor, as it happens, because I'm going to focus primarily, over the next few lectures, on areas where states could cooperate more than they do in the realm of economics. I do that not because economic cooperation is the only area with foregone benefits, but because it is one of the most important ones, one that affects our daily lives, and yet is poorly understood by most people. If you are interested in hearing more about other areas of cooperation, check out the optional lectures on the global environment, arms races, alliance formation, human rights, and economic and political development. Turning to the first slide, I lay out for you there three more specific goals for this lecture. First, I will discuss the potential benefits of free trade. Second, I will clarify the relationship between exchange rates and trade. Finally, I will discuss the potential benefits from free migration, which many people view as more different from trade than I think it actually is, in the sense that those who oppose immigration most strongly tend to be pretty strong supporters of free trade, and those who are most critical of new trade agreements tend to be the most supportive of immigration. I'm going to try and convince you in this lecture that, at least in terms of the economic implications, immigration and trade are so similar that if you're a supporter of the one, you should probably be a supporter of the other. I acknowledge that there are some complicating factors, and it's not impossible to justify holding different views on these two issues, but you need to do some work to get there. Similarly, I should clarify now that just because I want you to be aware that there would be enormous benefits to cooperating more than we currently do, to removing all remaining barriers to trade and migration, doesn't mean I'm endorsing such policies. It might sound like it, I get that, but all I'm doing for now is setting up a puzzle. There are reasons why states don't embrace free trade and migration. Whether they're good reasons in a moral sense, I leave for you to decide. My goal is to help you understand why we don't see more cooperation, and to convince you that this is a question we really do need to ask, not to tell you what position to take on a complex matter of policy. While it's hard to deny that the world as a whole, and each individual country overall, would be better off if we removed all barriers to trade and migration, that doesn't mean there'd be no losers at the individual level. If we think states make decisions, as realists do, see the previous lecture, the fact that states don't adopt policies that would benefit them overall is a puzzle. If we acknowledge that leaders of states make decisions, and that they might be more politically responsive to those who lose out, that's a different story. And that will, of course, be part of the answer, eventually. For now, I just wanted to set the table, so to speak. Turn to the second slide, where our discussion of trade begins. As it says on the slide, more than 90% of academic economists agree that barriers to trade decrease aggregate welfare. Put differently, countries that have fewer barriers to trade tend to grow faster, and we have good reason to believe that's a causal relationship. Now, as I've already acknowledged, saying that a country as a whole would be made better off by trade is not the same as saying every single person within that country will be made better off. As we'll discuss more in a future lecture, trade creates both winners and losers. The point for now is just that it reliably creates more of the former than the latter, so it's something of a puzzle that states have only partially embraced it. especially since most of them have partially embraced it. That is, if nothing else, we need to explain why there are greater barriers to trade in some sectors than others, and why some countries are more supportive of trade than are others. And I'll offer an explanation for those exact things in a future lecture. You're free to decide, after hearing the facts, that barriers to trade are morally justified in spite of the aggregate economic benefits. Again, I'm not telling anyone what their politics should be, but it's just not worth it doesn't make for a very good explanation of why we don't see more trade than we do, because clearly most states in the world feel that at least some of the time, trading at least some goods with at least some countries is worth it. There's too much trade out there currently for us to say the reason why there isn't more is because it's a bad idea. Okay, let's get a little more precise. I'm saying money's being left lying on the ground. You might reasonably ask, how much money? Estimates vary, I have to admit. Quite a bit, in fact. And those at the high end are much smaller than the numbers I'll throw around later in the lecture, since barriers to trade are already quite low. We'll talk more about when and why they came down in a future lecture, but for now, I need to acknowledge that the flow of goods and services across borders is much less restricted today than it once was, which is another way of saying most of the potential benefits are already being achieved, and there's not much we'd say is foregone. The most optimistic figure I've come across suggests that removing all remaining barriers to trade would increase world GDP by 3%. Incidentally, by world GDP, I just mean the GDP of every country added together. And GDP stands for Gross Domestic Product, a measure of total economic activity, or income, generated by an economy. In other words, there'd be more stuff to go around, but not a whole lot more. At the time of this recording, world GDP is in the neighborhood of $80 trillion. So 3% of that is around $2.5 trillion. That sounds like a lot because it's such a big number, but to put that in perspective, suppose your first job coming out of uni pays about £40,000 or euros or whatever a year. A pay increase of 3% is going to bump that up by just over 1,000. That'd be nice, you certainly wouldn't say no to it, but I can't sit here and say that when it comes to trade, states are passing up enormous benefits, because they're not. At one time, they were. The fact that there's not a whole lot of benefit left unrealized doesn't mean that trade doesn't bring with it huge, huge benefits. It does, and has, already. Put differently, a lot of fruit has been harvested already, and it was great. But there's some left on the high branches. Not a lot, but some. And we want to know why no one has picked it, and why they've also left some of the low-hanging ones. Turn to the third slide. I'm now going to try to explain exactly how it is that trade creates benefits for every country as a whole, if not every individual within every country. The short answer is that the benefits don't really come from trade as such. It's not the act of exchanging goods and services across borders that makes people better off. It's that there's more stuff to go around if resources are used efficiently. That is, put towards their highest valued use. In other words, the real magic comes from specialization. And that argument applies to how people spend their time within any given organization, locality, or region, as well as it does states. The invisible line separating different countries, which we all agree to treat as real even though they're in some sense arbitrary, don't actually have much to do with it. When states try to provide for their every need on their own, though, pursuing policies of self-sufficiency, they're not able to allocate resources as efficiently. They're not going to specialize to the extent that they could if they were open to trade. That's more true of smaller, less diverse states, but it applies on some level to every state. So, suppose we have two states. One is a relatively rich republic, that I'll call R for short, and the other's a relatively poor country, I'll call Pooristan, or just P. The way to read the next bullet point is as follows. R receives zero utility if it consumes less than 8 units of E in a year, and utility equal to the number of units of L that it consumes otherwise. Here, ER stands for how much E is consumed by R, and the same goes for LR, with E referring to essential goods and L leisure goods. For those unfamiliar with that distinction, which is common in economics, essential goods are things you need to survive, while leisure goods are things you want because they make your life more comfortable or enjoyable. Some measure of housing, healthcare, food, and clothing are essential. You don't need to live in the biggest house, dine out in the fanciest restaurants, or wear designer clothes, but if you aren't getting a certain amount of these things, you've got a serious problem. Anything you spend on entertainment, though, is an indulgence. I don't mean that pejoratively, like you're a bad person if you've ever spent any amount of money on music or movies. I just mean that if you had to cut back, you wouldn't like it, but your life would go on. So while the formal notation may be intimidating for some of you, all I've said with this bullet point is that the people of Rich Republic feel they need 8 units of housing, healthcare, food, and clothing in order to get by. Provided those needs are met, their collective level of happiness is basically determined by how entertained they are. The story is similar for the people of Pooristan, but they have a more modest sense of what's necessary. They only require 4 units of E. Once they've got that, their level of happiness is also entirely determined by how much L they consume. In case this isn't already obvious to everyone, the subscripts on E and L just differentiate the amount of the same type of good that is consumed by the different countries. That is, ER and EP refer to the same type of thing, but the first one tells us how much of it the people of Rich Republic consume, whereas the second tells us how much the people of Pooristan consume. These figures need not be identical, and indeed there's no reason to expect them to be. That's how happy they'd be at different levels of consumption, which is important, but not as important as this next part. Let's now talk about what they can produce. As it says on the slide, each month, R can produce 2 units of E or 10 units of L. There's no subscripts here because I'm assuming, for the sake of simplicity, that all anyone cares about is how much they consume, not where it came from. Obviously, that assumption doesn't always hold in the real world, but the basic point I'm trying to make would hold even if we allowed for what's known as product differentiation. So let's keep things simple. So, 2 of E or 10 of L for the Rich Republic. Or 1 unit of E and 5 of L. They don't necessarily have to do just one thing the whole month. And Pooristan can produce 1 unit of E or 2 units of L each month. To keep it simple, let's say Pooristan does have to devote the entire month to one or the other. Otherwise, we need to deal with fractions, which wouldn't be the worst thing I've done to you in terms of maths, but wouldn't add anything to the story either. Note that the rich country is far more productive in an absolute sense. If they focus all their effort on producing E, they would produce twice as much as P could if P were to focus all of their effort on producing E. The difference is even starker when it comes to L, where R outproduces P by a factor of 5-1. So R is better at both tasks. That's important. The case for trade revolves around a concept known as comparative advantage. I'll define that more precisely soon. For now, just note that the question of whether it's better to trade than pursue self-sufficiency, and it shouldn't surprise you to hear that we'll soon see that trade would in fact be in the interests of both rich republic and Poristan, has nothing to do with absolute advantages in production, which R has, and that might make you think that P has nothing to offer them, but you'd be wrong. Because while P does not have an absolute advantage in the production of either good, we're about to see that they do have a comparative advantage in the production of E, and that is enough to make trade mutually beneficial. And, it turns out, with two or more countries and two or more goods, everyone always has a comparative advantage in something. Finally, before we move on, just note that a state's annual production is simply the sum of the monthly production figures. That is, if a country spends 6 months producing E and 6 months producing L, then they get 6 times what they can produce in any given month of E and 6 times what they can produce in any given month of L, and so forth. The only reason that's important is because, as you may have forgotten already, the utilities I laid out above are based on annual consumption. If they weren't, if those numbers were per month, everyone would be dead because they'd never produce enough E. Turn now to the fourth slide. Let's first talk about what would happen if they both decided to consume only what they could produce. If they went down the path of self-sufficiency, pursuing a policy economists sometimes refer to as autarky, because they don't want to have to depend on anyone. Well, that is actually possible. They can meet their needs for essential goods and still get to consume some amount of leisure goods. That doesn't sound so bad, does it? But it takes each of them 4 months to produce the necessary level of E, leaving them no more L than they can each produce in 8 months. For R, that's 80 units, 10 per month. And for P, it's 16, 2 per month, which gives us a total of 96 units of L being consumed. Keep that figure in mind. Let's compare that to the alternative. If R would have spent all their time producing L, and P all their time producing E, then after 12 months, 12 units of E would have been produced, which is precisely how much is called for. 8 for R and 4 for P. Remember, P can produce 1 unit of E per month, so that works out perfectly. Of course, everyone's essential needs were being met above as well, so what we really care about is L. Here's the punchline. When R spends all of its time producing L at a rate of 10 units per month, they produce a total of 120 units per year. Above, only 96 units were produced between the two countries. That's a surplus of 24 units. And since R desperately needs 8 units of E, which P has no real use for, they can divide that 120 up however they want, and at least one of them will be better off than they would have been before, without anyone needing to be worse off. How can we be sure? Well, I'm telling the story as if they made their production decisions first and then decide to negotiate. But P would never bother producing 8 extra units of E without some assurance from R that they'd get at least 16 units of L from them. They can make this enforceable by delivering 1 unit of E to R per month once their own needs were met, and switching all of their production back to L if R ever tried to screw them over. And, for their part, R could... Well, let's just say that trade negotiations can get pretty tense, especially when states are preparing to sign new agreements, but that doesn't change the basic point that there's more to go around if states specialize in trade. No one's saying the benefits are likely to be distributed equally, just that everyone is better off than they would be if they tried to go it alone. Just to be sure everyone's on the same page, what I've shown is that if P specializes in the production of E, and R specializes in the production of L, there'll be more stuff to go around. And that's true even though P is worse than R, objectively, at the production of both goods. Surprising as it may be, Rich Republic needs Poristan. Why is that? Because R is so good at producing L that for them to spend any time doing anything else is a travesty. Every unit of E they produce effectively robs the world of 5 units of L that could have existed. Where did I get that number? Well, every month R can produce 2 units of E, 10 units of L, or 1 of E and 5 of L. If R chooses that last option, they'll have produced 5 fewer units of L than they could have, and all they'll have gained is 1 unit of E for their trouble. So that's why I say every unit of E that R produces is robbing the world of 5 units of L that could have been produced instead. No, P is not particularly good at producing E, but someone has to do it. These are essential goods, after all. And each unit of E that they produce only robs the world of 2 units of L. Because they can either produce 2 units of L or 1 unit of E, and doing the latter means not doing the former. That's a much smaller sacrifice. What I'm talking about here, as some of you are surely aware, is opportunity costs. If you've never heard that term before, which is fine, it simply refers to what we could have had if we'd behaved differently. It's not a cost in the sense that we have to give up something we currently possess, but it's still a loss in a certain sense. For example, when you go to the restaurant, the price of your meal is the direct cost, but the opportunity cost of your order includes all the other things you looked at on the menu and almost ordered, but didn't, and so now won't get to try. Unless you went with a group and someone there orders one of the other dishes and offers to share, but whatever, you get the point. Opportunity costs aren't as obvious as direct costs, but they're every bit as important, and you'd be wise to start thinking about them in your daily life. So, because R has a larger opportunity cost for producing E, they have a comparative advantage in producing L. Similarly, P has a larger opportunity cost for producing L. When they do so, they give up half a unit of E, whereas R only gives up 1/5 of a unit. So P has a comparative advantage in producing E. Because these things are based on relative costs, We don't need P to be better than R at producing anything in absolute terms in order for them to have a comparative advantage. I should say that rich republic doesn't need poorer stand specifically. It's just that the world is better off if rich republic's economy is entirely devoted to producing leisure goods. And in this simple example, the only way for that to happen is if Poristan takes over the necessary work of providing essential goods. If there was some third country that wasn't as good as R at producing L, but was better than P at producing E, then we might want that country to produce E. I say might, though, because it would depend on how good they are at producing L. Again, it's not absolute advantage that we care about. It's comparative advantage. Put simply, there's more stuff to go around if everyone minimizes their opportunity costs, which again represent all the stuff that we could have had if we'd behaved differently. We don't want to be passing up on any more than we have to. Put that way, I hope, the point becomes quite clear. But it's all too easy to forget to take opportunity costs into account, at least if you haven't been trained to think this way. Incidentally, the same argument applies within countries. That is, when people encourage you to buy local, they're encouraging you to leave money lying on the ground. Not literally, of course, nor, I suspect, intentionally, but that's still what you'd be doing if you were to listen to them. There may be environmental reasons for leaving that money there. I'm not sure about that, as more CO2 is emitted when individual farmers make separate trips to market with a couple of boxes of produce each, instead of a fleet of big lorries carrying tons of produce across great distances. But let's set that aside. Whatever other mitigating factors may or may not come into play, it is unambiguously true that the economic implications of buying local are, well, terrible. Sorry to be blunt, but they are. I sometimes joke that we already tried buy local. It was called the Dark Ages. The point is that specialization has an almost magical ability to conjure up more of what we buy. No, that's not the only thing that matters, but it shouldn't be dismissed lightly. Another practical implication of this is that developed countries, like the US and the UK, are doing the world a huge disservice by devoting as much resources as they do to agriculture. Yes, the world needs food, and these countries can be quite good at producing it. In some cases, they even have absolute advantages, not that anyone cares about those. No one can produce as much corn as the United States. But it's a horrible thing because of opportunity costs. In this day and age, what I'm about to say wasn't necessarily true in the 1900s, but it is today, most of the farming that the U.S. does uses high-tech equipment. That is, we're not just talking about labor being diverted from other sectors, which isn't even that big a deal considering how small a fraction of the U.S. workforce is employed in agriculture. Far more relevant is the fact that it's become a very capital-intensive enterprise. The money spent buying machines and fertilizer and genetically modified seeds, to say nothing of the money spent researching and developing these things, is money that is not spent on flying cars. Here I'm speaking figuratively, of course. We're never going to get flying cars. Sorry, internet memes. But the point is, the US is robbing the world of lots of really cool stuff. Not flying cars, but still cool, by pouring so much into agriculture, even though the U.S. produces a lot of food per hectare, because it does not have a comparative advantage in the production of food. Somebody else ought to be feeding the world. And the same goes for the UK, the rest of the EU, Japan, and so on. The world would be a lot richer, as a whole, if these countries got out of the food game and focused more on what they do best. Before moving on, I just want to say a little bit about imbalance trade. Turn to the next slide. The general public and an awful lot of politicians have an attitude towards trade that can be characterized as mercantilist. Mercantilism is the idea that a state is better off if it can boost its exports to other countries while minimizing imports. The difference between what a country imports and what it exports makes up its trade deficit, or surplus if the latter number is bigger than the former. And if you think having a large deficit is a really bad thing, congratulations, you're a mercantilist, which is not a compliment. Okay, to be fair, it's perfectly reasonable for people who lack expertise to think that trade deficits are bad. The media talks about them as if they are, after all, and that's who most of us turn to for our information about this sort of thing. But I hope, after this module, you won't make the mistake of obsessing over trade deficits, because they're really nothing to worry about. To see the point more clearly, step back and just think about what this sort of reasoning would mean in your daily life. Suppose you work full-time and never spend the money you earn on anything at all, ever. That would be like exporting lots of labor without importing any goods or services. Do that, and you will have a huge personal trade surplus. Now go to the other extreme. Suppose you never work a day in your life, yet despite that, people are still willing to give you stuff. You'd have a horrible trade deficit, like the worst ever. But admit it, part of you thinks that would be kind of awesome, doesn't it? Maybe even a large part? When you bemoan your country's trade deficit, you are effectively complaining about countries selling you too much stuff without asking for enough in return. Seriously, it's a little more complicated than I just made it sound, but not a lot. Let's take that a step further. People sometimes complain about other countries manipulating the value of their currency in order to artificially boost their exports. This is a common charge leveled against China, especially in the US. There are members of Congress who want to make that accusation official, and they've come close to getting their way. What they're accusing China of is selling Americans stuff they want for less than it's really worth. And that's somehow bad? Really? Well, for some people it is, like those who own or work for American companies that compete with Chinese ones, since the American company can't afford to stay in business very long while selling at prices as low as those of their Chinese competitor, assuming the charge is even true. So I can understand why those people would complain. But everyone else who lives in a country that imports lots of goods from China, be it the US or elsewhere, should be asking China to devalue their currency even further. The only reason we don't is because the businesses that compete with Chinese ones lobby politicians to demonize trade practices that are in fact bad for them, but are really good for you and me, and most of us fall for it. Now, admittedly, persistent imbalances could be harmful under certain conditions. If the US buys more stuff from China than China does from the US, then China is going to be holding a lot of greenbacks. And indeed, they do. That means that, in principle, they could flood the market suddenly and drive down the value of the dollar. That is, they could create inflation in the US. They don't have as much power to do that as the US Fed, but only the Fed is supposed to have that power, so it's a concern, I guess. But it's not clear what China would get from doing so. In fact, in the summer of 2015, China's government started selling a lot of treasury bonds they were holding, which are basically government IOUs or slips of paper that allow the holder to demand that the U.S. government give them a fixed amount of dollars, which isn't literally the same as flooding the market with actual dollars, but might as well be for all intents and purposes. And nothing happened. Well, not nothing. People bought them and China had a little more money to spend, but it didn't bring the U.S. economy to its knees or anything. You'd have heard about it if it did. We'll talk more about inflation in a future lecture. If you didn't follow all the details of what I just said, that's fine. I'm not going to ask you about currency manipulation on the take-home test. The point is just that trade is not a competition you need to win. People talk as though exports are akin to goals scored in a football match and imports goals allowed, but that's the wrong way to think about it. Exports are what we give other countries in exchange for stuff we want. You don't want to maximize the hours you work while minimizing your personal consumption. If anything, you'd like to do the opposite. So, to recap, trade is an important example of economic cooperation. There's a lot of it going on currently, but not as much as there could be, and that means there's money left lying on the ground. There are foregone benefits of cooperation. These benefits don't come from shipping containers crossing borders, but from specialization. It's just that it's impossible to specialize fully if you refuse to trade, because there are some things that you just need, and if you're not trading with others, you're going to provide them for yourself. And while I suppose it's good to be able to say that you could if you ever had to, actually doing so means wasting your time doing things someone else could do for you at lower cost. Well, lower opportunity cost anyway. But don't go thinking those matter any less than the conventional sort. Yes, within countries, trade creates winners and losers. We'll talk more about that later. But the world as a whole would be wealthier if every country removed all remaining barriers to trade. And every country as a whole would be wealthier too. So there is a real puzzle here, one I'll try to explain in future lectures. Now might be a good time to take a break. Listen to the trade section of this lecture again and make sure that you understand everything. Or just go do something else while you absorb what I've said so far, because that was a lot, and much of it challenging, I suspect. That is, now that we're starting to talk about actual international relations, rather than tools we might use to study international relations, you've probably heard me criticize views that you hold. If I haven't yet, I probably will before this lecture is over. No need to take that all in at once. Okay, ready? Let's talk for a bit about how exchange rates influence trade. First, I need to introduce some terms. Many of you are probably wondering what the heck an exchange rate even is. I certainly didn't know what they were back when I was in your position, which was more years ago than I care to admit. But it's not that complicated. An exchange rate is how much of one currency you can get for a certain amount of another one. So they apply at the level of the dyad. The UK has one exchange rate for the euro, another for the dollar, another for the yuan, and so on. And what I want to talk about, briefly, is the different types of exchange rates, because we're going to come back to that later in the lectures on how domestic politics and systemic forces impact patterns of cooperation. There are essentially two types of exchange rates. That's a bit of a simplification, because there are sort of hybrid exchange rates that fall somewhere between these two extremes, but we don't need to get into that. For our purposes, it's sufficient to contrast fixed and floating exchange rates. A country is said to have a fixed exchange rate if its currency has a value that is tied to that of another country's currency or to a particular commodity. The most common example of the former is the US dollar. The latter, gold. When you hear people talking about the gold standard, they're talking about exchange rates, though that isn't always clear, and often isn't the reason they care, but we'll get to that later. The UK was once on the gold standard and pressured others to adopt it as well. The US sort of did the same for a while after World War II with the Bretton Woods system, but they were a little more flexible about it. A country is said to have a floating exchange rate when the value of its currency is set by supply and demand. That means it's free to bounce around. Daily fluctuations tend to be small, but if a country's got a floating exchange rate, and these days most do, the value of their currency vis-a-vis others is constantly changing. Thinking about the supply of and demand for a currency doesn't come naturally to most people. After all, currencies are simply things we use to conduct exchanges. What gets handed over to the supplier by the one with the demand? Why would anyone give up currency in exchange for other currency? Well, some of you already know the answer. One obvious reason is because you're about to go abroad and you can't buy anything in a foreign country using currency from your home country. But that's just one small determinant of demand for currency. Trade itself has an effect on exchange rates, which is a bit confusing since I'm about to talk about how exchange rates affect trade. So do financial investments. But perhaps the biggest factor, or at least the one I'm going to talk about most in future lectures, is how governments manipulate the supply of their currencies with their monetary policy. This brings us to the next slide. The primary downside to adopting a fixed exchange rate is that it requires states to either impose capital controls or give up control of their monetary policy. Capital controls are governmental attempts to prevent money from leaving the country, either across the board or just in specific ways. They're rarely successful and tend to cause panic, though they may serve an important role in helping to stabilize an economy in crisis. But in normal times, at least, economists argue that it's best to avoid them. And most countries do these days, so I'm not going to say much more about them. Why do states want control over their monetary policy? Is it just because people liked being in control most of the time? Not really, no. It's because monetary policy is a powerful tool for controlling inflation, either keeping it down or driving it up. And yes, sometimes governments do that deliberately, though you'll have to wait until the lecture on domestic politics and cooperation to hear why. Hint, inflation doesn't quite mean what you think it means. It doesn't mean that everything's becoming less affordable. So, the benefit of having a floating exchange rate is that you leave yourself the option of tinkering with inflation, which can be useful for both political and economic reasons that I'm not going to go into just now, given how long this lecture is already going to be. What about fixed exchange rates? Well, because a country with fixed exchange rates has promised the rest of the world that they won't fool around with the value of their currency by tinkering with inflation, it's going to be more attractive to do business with firms located in that country. If investors and businesses in other countries know exactly how much the pound sterling is going to be worth tomorrow, 6 months from now, 18 months from now, it's a little easier for them to plan and to do business with companies in the UK. No one likes to renegotiate spoken contracts last minute. If a British business orders 600 widgets from a German one, but then decides last minute that they can only pay for 500, the German firm is less likely to accept any orders of any size from them again in the future. And while there's no guarantee that stuff like that would never happen if the British government went back on the gold standard and thus adopted a fixed exchange rate, the odds of it doing so would be lower, because that'd be one less piece of volatility. There'd still be uncertainty about that specific firm's performance, but not about the relative purchasing power of the pound sterling. Think about it the other way around. If business is humming along, and the British firm would otherwise expect to produce and sell the same number of finished whatchamacallits, but the pound sterling becomes weaker relative to the euro, well, then suddenly a perfectly steady business finds itself unable to pay for all the German widgets it ordered. Because the demand is still there, and they've got everything else they need to meet their production numbers, but for all intents and purposes, the price of those widgets has gone up. Not because the German firm has raised their prices, but that makes no difference to our hypothetical British business owner. They still can't pay. Now, suppose all the major economies have their currencies tied to the same thing. That should have a big impact on global trade. And that's not just hypothetical. As I said before, the UK used to pressure other countries to adopt the gold standard. And at that time, we did in fact see higher levels of economic cooperation, but only among the states that actually adopted the gold standard. Dyads that shared the gold standard had levels of trade 30 to 60% above those of other dyads, according to one study. That's not a huge amount, I suppose, but it's not trivial either. Admittedly, that only establishes a pattern of association, and I spent a lot of time in a previous lecture trying to convince you that establishing causation is a different matter entirely. But I also said that we need to be most concerned about that when we have no clear theoretical mechanism by which X might exert a causal influence on Y, or if we have a rival theory that can account for the pattern without implying any causal relationship between X and Y. As near as I can figure, neither of those things is true here. We definitely do have a mechanism, and to the best of my knowledge, there's no obvious Z that would both account for sacrificing control over monetary policy on the one hand and higher levels of trade on the other. At least, not above and beyond the ones the authors of that study already accounted for, and there were quite a few of those. So, no, that's not definitive, but it's highly suggestive. Tentatively, then, I think we can say that fixed exchange rates do in fact promote trade. Probably. So, the fact that most countries now have floating exchange rates is probably depriving the world of cooperation in the form of trade, which, as we've discussed, benefits every state in aggregate, if not every single person within every state individually. More foregone benefits, and another puzzle to explain in future lectures. Incidentally, all the arguments I just made about fixed exchange rates applied to common currencies like the euro, because those also reduce uncertainty for the same reason, yet require states to give up control over their monetary policy. I'll talk more about who supported adopting the euro and how well that maps onto theoretical arguments about winners and losers from trade and inflation in a future lecture. Finally, turn to the last slide, and let's briefly talk about migration. There's actually pretty good reason to believe that barriers to migration are the worst example of foregone benefits of all the ones that we've discussed so far. Barriers to migration are effectively barriers to specialization in almost exactly the same way that barriers to trade are. If the people of Rich Republic are better off devoting all their time and energy to producing leisure goods, some of which they trade away to the people of Poristan in exchange for essential goods, does it really matter whether the goods have to cross international borders to make that happen? I already said above, no, not really. If the people of Poristan are allowed to move to Rich Republic, and if they can produce just as much E there, in fact, they'd almost certainly produce more, then there's just as much surplus value, or more, created by opening up the borders as by shipping goods across the ocean. Yes, there are a lot of other considerations that now enter the equation. Cultural preservation, crime rates, etc., etc. A lot of those objections to immigration are overblown. Study after study shows that immigrants assimilate much faster, much more fully than skeptics realize, and the impact on crime is often found to be either negligible or even negative. But I don't really want to get too deep into a debate about all the other implications of immigration at the moment. I'll talk more about some of these arguments and acknowledge that even in terms of pure economics, there are winners and losers from allowing people to move freely across borders, the same as with goods and services, when we get to the lecture on domestic politics. All I want to say for now is that states are foregoing enormous economic benefits, and that's a puzzle. I said earlier in this lecture that I couldn't claim that a huge amount of money was left lying on the ground when it comes to trade, because states have mostly embraced trade already. The same cannot be said of migration. And for that reason, credible estimates suggest that world GDP would double if all remaining barriers to migration were removed. That's a lot more than a 3% increase. Many trillions of dollars are being left on the ground, not just a few. Just a few trillion, he says. Well, in comparison to what we're talking about now, that $2.5 trillion I mentioned previously really is a paltry sum.